right, cool. Good morning, guys. Thank you for coming to these sessions, avoiding the on-premises SharePoint train wreck. This session is going to be delivered by me and Wayne Ewington. So this session is basically going to discuss about the common findings that we see in the field, as well as the guidance that we have from Microsoft if you are sort of planning to design or to deploy your SharePoint on-premises environment.
Hang on a second. Well, I must admit, I mean, I've been in this room quite a bit this week, and this is the fullest I've ever seen this room so far. And this is actually a little bit scary. This kind of means that a lot of people out here are actually worried about their own potential train wrecks that could happen with their SharePoint environments. I'm also a little bit nervous as well, because I do recognize quite a number of my customers and clients who have actually gone through and designed and built their SharePoint farm. So hopefully they're not here to kind of keep me honest and see what happens. So, but anyway, great to be here, and back to Barry.
Right, cool. Thanks, Wayne. A little bit about me, that I work for Microsoft New Zealand as a senior primary field engineer, and I've been with Microsoft for almost more than 8 years. And I do not only SharePoint, I do also Ling or Skype for Business. I'll be doing Auckland Marathon in November, and I've been working out to do my marathon, and those are some of the pictures that I took while I was doing the practice.
Okay. So obviously Barry's not going to be watching the Rugby World Cup because he's doing the Auckland Marathon, right? So, because the All Blacks are going to be in the final, right? Okay, so a little bit about myself. My name's Wayne Ewington. I'm a principal consultant for Microsoft New Zealand. I've been with Microsoft now for just coming up to 15 years. So a little bit of a long time. And when we had the keynote on, when was it, Tuesday night, I actually was one of the people that had the 20 T-shirts, which I had to stand up for. So a couple of colleagues reminded me that I'm probably a little bit of a loser as a consequence of that, but here I am. I've done a collage of photos. Usually what I do is that I say, each one of these photos actually represents a story about myself. So what I like to do, just as a little bit of something different, anybody can choose a photo, and I'll give you the background story behind that. Which, the Lone Ranger, good question. Okay, the Lone Ranger. That usually grabs people's attention. Okay, so within Microsoft, we used to have a group of people which were called the SharePoint Rangers. And then we used to do work for the product team. So basically, the product team would pay us to go out and work on some of the hardest implementations around the world. And I was the ranger for the APAC region. I was the only one in the APAC region, so I was the Lone Ranger. Thank you for doing that. Okay. So what we're going to do, we've basically broken this up into looking as wrap as a service. So because we've got Barry here, he runs this wrap. So basically what this is a bit of a service that actually goes through where we go through and review on-premises deployments of SharePoint. So he's going to give you a little bit of background and information around what exactly is that. From that, we're going to then look at what are some of the common issues that we see with SharePoint deployments. Okay, so some of the common things that we've actually got out there. We're then going to look at how you can go through and do some performance monitoring. So as you're going through doing your on-day, you know, operational guidance and all that stuff that goes with that, how you can do some performance monitoring around this. And then I'm going to talk around how you can actually start future-proofing your environments. What can you start doing now to make it easier should you want to move to the cloud in the future? Also, some of the things that could actually make it easier to help avoid that potential train wreck that could actually happen as part of your current deployments that you've got out there. Then we're going to go out and talk around these other considerations, some of these softer things that we don't often think about because we tend to be a bit more technologists, and some of these other things can actually drive and actually make your on-premises deployments a lot more better. So with that, back to Barry.
Right, so I'm going to cover the wrap as a service. So basically, wrap as a service is Microsoft services offering from Microsoft Premier Services, where we proactively look at a customer environment and sort of provide recommendations based on the findings that we have. So for SharePoint, so related wrap as a service, we basically assess the following technology and processes. So we basically assess the SharePoint components, and then we sort of look at into the SQL Server configuration that is related with SharePoint. And then we not only look at the configuration side, but we also look at your processes and operation as well. And we sort of look at from your operating system configurations as well. Thus, you're gonna look at some of the findings that I'm gonna present are basically related with these components. And what's the processes for this wrap as a service? Basically, we have a data collection tools that collects information from your on-premises environment, as well as doing a operational interview, which we can't cover by the data collections, and then you sort of submit the data to our analysis engine, and then we as an engineer will sort of do the data analysis and provide recommendation based on the findings. So some of the findings that you're gonna sort of look at in these presentations are basically coming from my experience looking at specifically customers in New Zealand. So a little bit about the value of the wrap as a service. So basically the value of this is for a customers to understand what do they have in their environment, what's the risk or what's the health issue from Microsoft recommendations and sort of a guidance as well. And we also sort of do knowledge transfer to explain to customer why this issue is important to your environment, as well as how you can basically remediate the issues that have been identified. And the issues that are found in the environments are, it could be quite different. They could be there because of number of different reasons, and we sort of there to sort of give the knowledge transfers to you and sort of make this relevant to your environment. And we also have the remediation plan. So based on the discussions that we have, the issues that we found, we sort of provide you with how you could sort of improve, remediate the issues that have been found in your environment. So what are some of the common issues that are found in customer environment? So one thing that I sort of overlook at customer environments always is SQL Server configurations. This is something that is often overlooked. Something always not really right in terms of the SQL Server configuration. So
would it be fair to say, Barry, is that if you've got a performance issue in your environment, we would be the first place you would look?
Yeah, I think we'll be looking at the SQL Server because that's basically the sort of the core and the heart of your SharePoint performance. So this is really related with the performance of your SharePoint environment.
Cool. So if you want SharePoint to hum, make sure SQL Server is working really, really well. Okay?
Cool.
So any of the optimizations that you do, the first place to really start off is actually looking at SQL Server. So hence, one of the first things that we need to look at from a SQL Server configuration perspective is looking at the disk layouts, okay? Optimizing those, making sure that they do, you know, are in the most optimal type of configuration. We're gonna go into a bit more detail around what would be some ideas around how you can actually optimize the disk layouts associated with this.
Yep, cool. The other thing about SQL Server as well is the TemDB configuration. So there are a number of recommendations for the TemDB. Why we sort of check TemDB intensively, because this is where all of the temporary SQL executions are being executed. So the performance of the TemDB is going to affect your SharePoint performance in general. And the other thing that is sort of often quite overlooked as well is the power setting on the SQL Server. So if you come with the default power setting, that will sort of have a balanced power setting. That's really on your operating system power setting on your SQL servers. So what that does, basically, it will make your SQL server to sort of go into like a sleep mode or like a standby mode when it's not really doing a lot of work. But when the work comes, it might sort of takes a little bit of time to sort of really wakes up.
Okay. So what we're going to look at now is just going to a little bit more around the disk layouts. So basically, you know, this is a lot of this is common DBA, SQL Server type optimization things you should be considering. However, as SharePoint people, because SharePoint is so dependent on SQL Server, we've got to make sure that, you know, our SQL environment is actually laid out correctly. So what this basically means, one of the first things we should be doing is having separate drives for different purposes. Okay, so if you think about where are my log files going, where are my database files going, where are my backup files going, ideally they should actually be on different drives. We've also got to look at the disk latency associated with that as well. So basically for a database, we need about 15 milliseconds, for logs, 2 milliseconds. And you can actually go through and look at the perf counters associated with this. If you're not sure how your disks are actually performing, what we've got to do is actually go through and have a look at this, look at the average disk second read and the average disk second write. Have a look at those performance counters and they will actually determine what is your disk latency. Are you actually optimizing this appropriately? The other thing you can do too is look at prioritizing your disks. Okay? So if you've got an SSD, you know, because all of us have got those sitting in our servers or on our SANs, right? But if you can go through and actually put your fastest disks out there, what we should be doing is putting out our disk for the tempdb, because that's going to be the one that gets hit all the time, okay? If you want to optimize it, get that fast as possible, make sure tempdb is your fastest disk that you've got, followed by your logs, followed by your database, followed by your OS, and then backups. We don't care how long they take to go, right, so long as they do get done. So it really comes through and trying to lay out those disks to get the best optimization we can out of that. The other thing we need to think about too is around the tempdb. Now, Barry did allude to this, okay? That once again, this is a SQL Server optimization, but SharePoint, because it uses SQL in some weird and wonderful ways, okay, we do need to optimize our tempdb as much as possible. So what we should be doing here is actually only having one transaction log file. If we can, use RAID 10, because that's going to be the fastest. Pre-size the tempdb files. Now, this becomes quite interesting. The guidance here says you should pre-grow the tempdb to 25% of your largest SharePoint database. Okay. What happens if you've got a 1 terabyte content database? How big should your tempdb be? 250 gig. Okay, pre-grown. Okay, that's a little bit of a shocker for some people, but that is the recommended guidance to get the best optimal performance from a SharePoint farm from a tempdb perspective. The other guidance we have around this too is to set the order growth to a fixed size if it's less than 200 megabytes. And what's the default setting? 1 meg originally with 1 meg extending. Okay, so it's not very efficient. So that also means you've got to go through and change the default settings on that. The other bit of guidance, which you can get quite a little, you know, quite a good performance kick out of, particularly if you have got multiple tempdb files, is to turn on the trace flag 1117. What that basically does is it ensures that you get an even auto growth against all of your files that you've got that are associated with your tempdb. Once again, this is SQL Server optimization type stuff, but as SharePoint people, we need to be aware about this to make sure that our DBAs are actually doing it. So I've kind of alluded to that we should probably have a little bit more than one file out there. So, what we recommend to do is that the number of tempdb data files should be the same number of data files as the CPUs, up to a maximum of 8. Okay? What you can do there, so the other question that often comes up is, what happens if I've got a virtualized machine? What type of CPU are you talking about? What we're talking about here is the logical processor. Okay, the logical processor that SQL is actually using as doing the processing, that actually determines how many CPUs we've actually got, and hence how many maximum number of data files up to 8 we should actually do. Now, another way we can do it from a SQL perspective, we can simply run the select star from sys.dm_os_schedulers, and that will give us a list of all the schedulers that it can see. And when we've got the numbers between, you know, that are lower than that 104 number, that basically determines how many CPUs, how many logical processes SQL Server can actually see. So if we do that, we then know how many SQL Server can see, and hence how many data files we should actually associate with TempDB.
Thanks, Wayne. So what's the other common findings that we sort of found in the field? So this is the other common findings in the fields that we sort of see more than 5,000 items in a view, in a list view, or more than 8 lookup field columns in a list. This could be a problem, especially if you have a custom solutions that you built and you sort of tested without exceeding this number, and the solutions was working great initially. Everything sort of works fine until it then sort of hit into like this 5,000 item limit, and your applications might sort of stop working or behave unexpectedly. Because this setting sort of put in SharePoint to prevent any performance degradations to the SharePoint environment.
So why do you think this was put in? I mean, this was introduced in SharePoint 2010, where we suddenly introduced this throttling, where we've got this limit, which you go into the central admin, you can set what the settings are per web application. What do you think these settings are about? Any ideas? It's about SQL performance, exactly. What is happening here, what can happen behind the scenes, is that if you do a select against the content database and you start bringing back a lot of rows, what can happen is that basically can, that data can be locked, okay? Because you could potentially could be updating that data. If you start bringing back a lot of data and a lot of rows, that lock can escalate into a table lock, okay? So hence, nobody else can do changes to that complete database. Once again, because SharePoint does some weird and wonderful things with SQL, okay, you've got a content DB, there's only one, for example, one list table within the content DB. So although you've got a list in there, there's actually that same table is being used by all the other lists, by all the site collections that are using that one content DB. So hence, if you get into the situation where you get an escalation up, you could be impacting the performance of everyone else. So this is actually, you know, this is the reason why we got these what we call the throttling locks put in place. Now the key thing about this is that because we've got 5,000 items, it's per view, okay? If you kind of digest that back a little bit, what that means is that it's whatever I'm retrieving back from SQL as part of that SQL transaction. So then you kind of start thinking about, well, I've gone into my list view and I've got a default view there. That should be okay, okay? Because I'm only saying the default setting there is only 30 items. You can go through there and change that to be whatever you want, okay? That's one way of actually increasing the SQL statement that's going out and pulling that data back. What about if you do a group by in that view? If you kind of think about the SQL statement that's happening that gets generated by SharePoint behind the scenes, if you've got a group by, it has to go out, bring all the data back, and then group it to bring it back. So hence, you could inadvertently get throttled because of that. Okay? One of those subtle things. The other thing, too, is that if you've got customizations out there, sometimes your developers don't think about that the list that they're going and accessing that data from, or getting it from, that list is going to grow and get bigger and bigger, and hence finally get to this 5,000 default limit, and hence their application was suddenly going to get blocked. Okay, so hence this is the reason why we've got in there. So this is one of the reasons why, as part of the wrap that we do, we always go through and just check to make sure how many items are in there. Are you doing anything? This could potentially be a risk into your environment that you could potentially start seeing performance issues with.
Okay, cool. Thanks, Wayne. So I think the other additions to this is if you develop a custom solutions on top of SharePoint with using List View, I would highly recommend you to test the populations of your list to more than 5,000 and then try using your application and see how it behaves. All right, so try to do a stress test or try to populate as much as possible if you can to sort of satisfy your business requirement and see the performance of
your application. Also another trip here, don't get your developers to do it. I'll tell you why. The way that list throttling works, there's a couple of little gotchas, okay? Particularly from a 2.10 perspective. If you're a local admin, on the box where you're running the stuff, you don't actually get throttled. Okay, developers are typically admin on the box where they're running and doing their development on. Don't do it. If you're a farm admin, you're probably going to be the local admin on the box as well, so hence the list throttling won't apply to you. Okay, something to watch out for.
All right, cool. So the other finding as well is the more than 10 applications pool in a single server. So that's actually not a good way of doing this. Like you create a single application pool for every single service applications that you provision, that's actually not the way to do that. That's going to take a lot more resources on your server.
And this is a common mistake we see, right? Unfortunately, if you're going through the central admin, you go to provision a new service application out, the UI kind of tends to make you want to create a new application pool for every service application. It kind of implies that, okay, because that's the default setting. Unfortunately, in reality, you don't actually need to do that. The issue here is that you've got these application pools. Every application pool that spins up, that's about 250 meg of memory gone like that, okay? You don't need them, okay? You don't usually need that isolation. The other thing to think about too is go into your IIS servers, look at the default application pools that get created whenever you install IIS, okay? You probably don't need them. Get rid of them, okay? Delete them, not required.
All right, cool. The other sort of common findings as well is sort of these errors that you might sort of see as well from your health analyzers. There's like missing server-side dependencies, which is basically an orphan feature. So this orphan feature, it could be because of the customizations that have been deployed in the previous versions, you upgraded them, but you don't sort of redeploy the solutions in the new environment, or it could also be because the deactivations of the feature didn't really clean up the artifacts that the developer sort of brought. So basically, sort of, you need to deactivate the feature properly, and if you're a developer, you sort of need to deprovision the resources that you sort of provisions when you sort of activate the feature properly as well.
So how common is this?
Yeah, it is really common, actually. I think it's almost every environment that I've sort of done the rest for sort of have this issue. So, yeah, I know it's going to take quite a lot of discipline and as well as sort of coordinations as well, developer and ops as well, to sort of try to make sure your environment sort of healthy. This is probably not an issue for the current running environment, but this could be a potential blocker if you are doing like upgrade or an update or patching to your environment.
Okay, and the majority of this is based on customizations, third-party customizations or in-house customizations?
Yeah.
Okay, so here's a listen for you, right? What we're hearing here is that a lot of the blockers that we've got here and some of the issues actually relate to in-house or third-party customizations that have been deployed into the farm. Okay, we'll leave it there for now. We'll come back to this.
All right. The other common orphan item as well is the side orphans. So the side orphans basically that a site seems to be appear in the configurations database or in the content database, but they are actually not accessible. What's the problem with that? So the problem of that, it could be like, for example, if the search sort of trying to crawl, it might sort of see that there is a site that it needs to crawl, but when it tries to crawl, it can't really get anything from the site because it's sort of orphaned, so one way or the other sort of broken either on the config or on the content database.
So how common is this one?
Yeah, I think this is not as common as the feature and web part often, but they do also happen actually at the customer environment.
Okay, how easy is it to create a site orphan?
Yeah, I think there could be a number of potential triggers to the site orphan. So one condition could be that, for example, the content database that is used by the SharePoint is sort of removed without detaching the content database from your SharePoint, sort of like the DBA just removed the database and sort of left the artifacts in your config database. The other way of this could happen as well, if you are doing a site provisioning and for some reason sort of the process sort of stop in the middle of the provisioning process of a new site creation, that could sort of cause this issue as well.
So we've actually got a couple of key points here. Where the sites are actually defined is not actually in the content databases. We've got what's called a site map, and that sits in the configuration DB. Okay? What we've got is that we've got the situation where we've got a content database sitting out there, and we've got the site map sitting over here, and we've got a mismatch between the two. It's actually surprisingly easy to get these out of whack. Okay? Barry gave an example where you could take the content DB and basically just remove it without actually doing a proper detach, you know, through SharePoint. That's one way of doing it. Also, the other way that another common way of getting these is that if you're trying to provision a new site, it goes wrong and you redo it. Okay? The second site comes in, but you could possibly have an orphan site sitting above there as well. Okay? I can very easily create this, unfortunately. Okay, but just be aware that you could actually have these out here. The good thing is that there is basically an article about how do you actually go through and detect and delete those orphan sites that are out on your farms.
Yeah. Cool. All right, so so we're getting into this more operational management that is something that is actually really important in SharePoint is not only the technology, but you need to have the people and processes to sort of really work on together and then make your environment sort of work better between your developer, your operations, your DBA. They sort of need to talk together and sort of make your environment sort of work for your environment. This is something really common. This is really common that there's no governance plans, there's no sort of this team doesn't really sort of talk to each other.
Yeah. And the reality is, where I've seen most SharePoint implementations go off the road or derail, hit that chain wreck, it's because there's been no governance plan established day one. So what that usually means is that as part of your design, your architecture of your environment, as you decide to bring SharePoint in, what you should be doing is that at the same time is thinking about your governance and getting that governance plan established immediately. Okay, the reason behind this is that SharePoint's a weird and wonderful beast, as we know, right? Is it a service? Is it a platform? Or is it an infrastructure? Unfortunately, it's actually all three of those, right? And so a lot of the times we come in and we decide to use it in one particular manner. We could decide to use it as a service, or we could decide to use it as an infrastructure, or as a platform that we're going to actually develop stuff on top of. Sometimes we get confused between that. Knowing what the governance and how we're going to maintain and use this environment from day one can save a lot of headaches and issues down the road. Okay? Critical thing. If you take anything away from this, make sure that you do have a governance plan in place day zero. And we're going to go into a little bit more detail about what exactly is a governance plan as one of the other sections coming up shortly.
All right, cool. What's the other common questions from customers as well? This is sort of the question that I've got as well for the routine maintenance task for SharePoint environment. So what should be done on a daily basis, weekly basis, or monthly basis, or as needed basis? So that's sort of a really common questions that I got as well. And we've actually got a good resources as well on that are sort of listed there.
So although it is for 2010 products, it still applies to 2013. Okay, so don't get misled. some of the guidance and all that still from 2010 still applies to 2013. Okay?
All right, cool. So we're getting into the baseline monitoring. So the idea of this is basically for you to do a regular either like performance monitoring as well as to understand the traffic that is coming to your SharePoint environment. How many of you sort of do this on a regular basis?
No one. So nobody monitors and looks at their farms on a regular basis, apart from you. But you work in Office 365. If you hadn't put your hand up, I would have been very concerned.
All right. So, yeah, okay. this is going to be important, especially if you run your important applications in your SharePoint environment, right? So we need to get sort of, you need to have sort of, this is one of the other takeaway that you should be doing as well. I sort of look at this by doing a regular server performance. So you sort of do a regular performance monitoring to your SharePoint environment and then analyze the results that have been collected. There's a really good tool for sort of analyzing the result and then understanding what they sort of mean as well by using these tools called PAL, Performance Analysis of Logs. I'm gonna show you as well later on in the demo. The other one is the site usage. The site usage is basically to understand the traffic that is coming to your SharePoint environment. Like, what is the request per second that you receive on certain time? Or like, what's the slowest page that you have in your SharePoint environment? What are the most requested extensions that you have in your SharePoint environment? So these informations are actually available in public, and we can sort of use this and take away and then start adopting this in your environment. So with that, I'm going to do a demo to show you some of these baseline performance monitoring and IS logs analysis.
Need to switch. So one. We have to try and guess Barry's password now.
All right, so I've got two demos here. So the first one is the baseline performance monitoring. I'm going to show you the counters, and I'm going to show you the tools that you can use to control this performance as well as the tools to analyze the results. So basically, we have a tools called Logman, and Logman is sort of built in within the operating system. And you can use it to create query, stop, or start performance counters in your system. I'll probably do a quick demo of this from my local environment. So this is the Logman. I'm going to try to sort of create a counter. I've got a command prompt already available here. And I'll probably just do a query to show you what this is going to look at. So the Logman query basically look at what's sort of happening in my performance collector list, and I don't have anything underneath of this performance monitor. And I'm going to try to schedule it. So I'm going to try to schedule this with this Logman create. So this is going to create the performance counter. So the command completed successfully, and we should see there is a counter created there. And I've got the performance file as well. I'm going to share it with you as well later on, the performance counter file later on. And with this, basically, we can sort of start the performance counter as well. So that sort of started it. It should started it. Sorry. Oh, yep. Mm. Yeah. But anyway, I'll probably show you how to use this, and I'll sort of show you the result as well later on. So So we can basically start-stop query and necessary with this logman, and then what is the result of this performance counter is basically will have a CSV file, and then this CSV file can then be analyzed with using PAL. And PAL, you can actually download it from pal.codeplex.com. Basically, it's really easy. You can sort of specify where is your file. This is the one that I've run in my test environment. It has got like 142 MB there. And it sort of asks what's the threshold file for, for example, sort of use the SharePoint Server 2010. And there's a number of questions as well that it will sort of go through. And it will basically process this. And I've got the output of that as well. So if you look at this, this is sort of the output of the PAL that gives you information of your system without really for you to really know what sort of the threshold, what sort of the all of the details. So you can look at from here easily that there's something not right with my processor, for example. There's something not right with my disk. So you can easily sort of generate these information and be able to get understanding of what's going on in your system. So that's sort of one takeaway that I want you to sort of have from this. The other way of doing the performance baseline also to understand the traffic that is coming into your environment. And there is actually a really nice a white paper that is written here like in 2009. So that's been there for a very long time actually. That's basically analyzing your SharePoint product and technology usage. This is basically analyzing the IIS logs that you've got. From here, let me just try to quickly show you this. So this is the IIS news. So basically what I have is the IIS log that I have captured from my server on certain day. So in here, we've got, for example, the IIS log from three servers. I've created some text file that contains the query that I took from the white paper. So this is like a SQL select queries that will generate the information that we need. And I've got a batch file that's basically doing the log parser query to the logs that I've got. And what we'll need, or what I need to do, is just to call that batch file. And it will create a number of CSV file that I can sort of pull together to sort of give you informations like this. Like we can sort of know what's the request per second that I got on this date in overall, so you can know what's the number of requests that is coming to your environment, what is sort of the request that your actual users actually create without any crawling or whatnot, because the crawling could sort of generate quite a lot of IIS traffic as well. You can basically know what's the top operations. You have a lot of 200 okay or whatnot. So there are a lot of useful informations that you can actually get by looking at the IIS logs, and it's really useful. So you know, we know what's the slowest page like. On, for example, previous month, what is the slowest page on, for example, this month? And you can sort of have more a proactive way of looking this rather than reactively, hey, I've got a really slow pages, but it's just like from the user complaint. We don't know where the actual page is, right? So by looking at this, you can actually know which page that is sort of the slowest and what might be causing that. Right, so... and if you grab the slides, you'll be able to sort of grab all of those performance counters as well as the IIS logs that I've sort of demoed there as well, so you can sort of deploy and use it in your environment.
So the key thing here is that if you do decide to download the PowerPoint deck, Barry's actually embedded those files into the slide, if you do want those. So hence those are actually attachments within the slide if you do want to use this for yourself going forward. Okay, so what we're going to do is that we're going to change tack a little bit and talk about how do you can future-proof and actually make sure that you're going to be aligned such that if an update occurs, because updates do occur, or if a new version does come out, how can you actually make it a little bit easier to move that to that particular version? So to help with that, basically, I kind of look at these deployment options, okay? So what we've got, if we kind of look at the inner circle, we've got Office 365 being in the public cloud, and we really regard that as being a standardized type deployment and structure. Coming outside of that, we then start talking about how do we do this from an on-premises perspective? And I'm going to do a little bit of marketing here and talk about something called the product line architecture. So this is a deployment type option that from Microsoft we've got, which enables you to have a very, very structured, recommended and supported design for your on-premises deployment that would actually help it make it easier to move forward if you want to in the future. Going outside of that, we then have got the on-premises recommended practices and guidances around how do you actually deploy a SharePoint environment. Basically, everything that's in TechNet is, you know, that's been defined around supportability boundaries and all that. So long as you stay within that circle, you're going to be okay. Moving outside of that, you're getting into an unsupported scenario, okay, which basically means all gloves are off. So if you start doing dumb things, like directly modifying the database schemas, you are instantly in an unsupported situation. Okay? Don't do it. Okay? Don't do it. So what this basically means is that if you kind of think about this product line architecture, what we've done is that we've come up and had a look at it and looked at the different types of deployment options that were done around the world. What we're trying to do as part of this product line architecture is reduce the support costs, try to bring the management costs of this down, reduce the complexity of the deployments. Now, the reason behind this is that if we kind of look around all the SharePoint deployments that happen around New Zealand, there's a lot of different people here that have got their own SharePoint farms. We look around the world, what we've noticed is that a lot of these farms have actually been deployed very, very differently. There's centers of excellence around how should a particular deployment be done, but there's no global guidance around what would actually be the best way of doing it. So what we've done is that we've come up with this product line architecture where we've worked with the engineering team to say, if you were to deploy a farm on premises, how would you do it? What would be the best way of actually doing it that would be good, consistent, reduce the support costs, reduce the management costs, etc. of that? And this is the other interesting thing here too. If you want to move to a cloud service such as Office 365 in the future, okay, because you know that's kind of where the products are going, what would be make it easier for you to do that going forward? Okay, so hence we've got these on-premises farms because we know we're going to have them today, but in the future you may want to be able to upgrade, or you may want to take your environment and move it into Office 365. What's going to be the easiest way to do it? And that was basically the design goals behind the product line architecture. So if we kind of look at the structure of this, the PLA guidance has got some very, very specific things associated with that. Essentially, if you look at what's in Office 365 today, okay, how things are structured in Office 365 today, take some of those concepts and bring them back onto your on-premises deployment. And that would actually make it a lot safer for you going forward. So some of these constructs and guidance around this is having, for example, a single web application. You're kind of going, well, okay, that kind of makes sense. What we have seen is that as part of the, you know, part of the application pool issue, we've seen a lot of organizations go out and deploy heaps and heaps of web applications. Once again, there's a lot of memory overhead and actually, you know, associate it with that. In 2013, we didn't actually have any guidance around how many web applications. Sorry, 2010, we didn't have any guidance around how many web applications you should have. In 2013, we changed the guidance to say 10. It doesn't really matter. It really depends on how much memory is on the servers. But for a common deployment pattern today, what we're recommending is that you have a single web application. but you're kind of thinking that doesn't scale. This actually scales very, very well. The reason behind that is that we changed the way that we actually deploy our site collections. Our guidance here is to use host name site collections. What that means is that we can actually scale this up and put a lot of things into the single web application and have these host name site collections sitting inside that. The ramification of that is that we can only deploy these using PowerShell. Bit of a downside, okay, but conversely, you know, having these hostname site collections actually means we're being more aligned to how Office 365 works. Also, the other point about this Office 365, you know, kind of concept out there, if you think about what the engineering team are doing, they're building and working primarily with Office 365. Okay, so that's where the effort is going. That's where the testing effort is going. They use hostname site collections in Office 365. What do you think is going to be tested more and is less likely to be, sorry, should have less bugs? Hostname site collections. Okay, so hence this is part of the reason why we're doing this guidance around here. The other thing too is that we have, what with their guidance is, one application pool for all of our services. Okay, I know the UI and central admin kind of dictates that we should have multiple, you know, service application pools per service application. Our guidance has changed where we just say one application pool, chuck all your services in there. Any isolation and all that around that, it's probably not going to give you much, okay? Unless you've got something very, very specific, you know, some very, very strong driver. You could have something that said, right, I do need to have a different service application and its own application pool because of security. Great, but then make sure that you do use a different service account. Because I've seen a lot of the times people do that and they use the same service account. Because it's the same service account, it's got the same privileges, your isolation's not actually going to be there. The other consideration too, and this is probably the biggest one out there, and why we've been trying to drive this hard, customizations are the bane of everything. Okay? They are really the blocker for taking us forward. That is, except for SharePoint apps. If you are doing customizations, your first thought should be, or your design goal should be, I want to do this as a SharePoint app. The reason behind this is that SharePoint apps work in Office 365 as well as on-premises. So hence, any customization that you do, you can, in theory, lift that customization up, put it into Office 365, and it will work. Not only that, what happens if your customization goes rogue? Not that they ever go rogue, right? They tend to pull down your farm, okay? They put performance issues into it. We talked about orphaned, you know, sites. We talked about orphaned features. Most of those are generated by customizations gone rogue. Hence, if you use a SharePoint app, that's a completely different type of model that works. If you do the SharePoint apps, if they go rogue, only that thing's going to go down and not work, but it's not going to impact your SharePoint environment. So hence, as part of Ignite, I was almost going to say TechEd, as part of Ignite, we've got a number of sessions talking about SharePoint apps. Okay, if you haven't gone to those sessions, go back and look at the Channel 9 recordings of those. Okay, go back and understand what we're trying to do with those. In fact, straight after this presentation, where there's another talk in here in this room talking about one of the partners who've gone through the process of changing their full trust solutions into SharePoint apps to make them more cloud ready. Okay, this is the way to go. Okay, think about this. This is important. So then we're going to change base or touch base or change threads a little bit again. We're going to talk about these other considerations. We talked about governance, okay? So governance, in my opinion, is probably more important, if not the same importance, as actually doing the original design and architecture of your on-premises farm. What this means is that you do need to get a governance policies in place. Now, the way that I kind of like to do these, I turn to talk about technical process and guidance, okay, where a technical thing is something you can technically implement into your environment. A process is something where you can go back and review, and a guidance is like a recommended practice. So when we go through and start documenting our policies, we can use the words can, cannot, may not, should not. And that will actually indicate what type of guidance we should actually have, what our policies are. Getting this up front and knowing exactly what we're going to do before we actually start using this environment, don't underestimate this. So some example policies that we could potentially have. We could say the test pre-production and production environments can, note the word can, so this is a technical implementation, automatically receive and install updates from Windows Update. Okay, so we know that we're going to actually allow our server to have internet access out so we can actually apply that update. We then got customizations. Full trace solutions may not be deployed into the environment. So this is like a guidance thing that we've got there. We're going to say that we can't technically stop them from doing it, but what we've got is that we're going to have a process around this to make sure that there's a good business reason for actually deploying that customization into that environment. The other one is all site selections should have at least two owners. So this is once again a recommended type practice. Okay, what happens if the user leaves? Who's going to own that particular site collection? There's no way of technically enforcing this, okay? But if we've got this as a governance policy straight up, at least we know what we're going to do. Imagine having to go back now and retrofit, you know, it's like 2,000 site collections that you've got in your deployment with a secondary site owner. Okay, it's going to be a little bit hard unless you go out and define that up front. So, over to you.
Cool. I think the other considerations as well is disaster recovery. I have only seen a couple of customers who actually really do disaster recovery properly. So basically the disaster recovery cover for you, it could have a disaster recovery environment available. And then you have a tested disaster recovery plan as well that is basically a working a DR plan. And the other part of the DR also is to do a regular DR drill exercise, like on maybe on an annual basis or whatnot. And so the first time
you do a failover should not be the time that you have to do it. Okay.
Yep.
Typically, okay, most organisations, most deployments are very, very guilty of this. They never test their DR strategy. They never test their DR plan. Okay. How many people here have tested their DR?
Or SharePoint?
Okay, good. Okay, so about a third of the room went up. Okay, that's actually, I'm very surprised. Okay, usually not many people do. So what that also then means is how are you going to handle your DR environment? Is it going to be a cold standby? Is it going to be a warm standby? I'm not going to say hot standby because it's actually impossible to get a hot standby for a SharePoint farm configuration. Okay, because that's basically a high availability. Okay.
There was a talk by Neil as well yesterday that was talking about Azure site recovery. If you're like wanting to look for a DR environment and then wanting to know what's the, I would say, a really good propositions of a DR environment as well, that's going to be a really a good solution for maybe a company who doesn't want to really invest a lot in the DR environment but you'd like to have a working DR environment that might sort of meet your business requirement. I would sort of recommend you to view Neil's session in Channel 9.
Yeah. So just another thing about the disaster recovery too. Okay. One of the best disaster recoveries I've ever actually seen in one of the organisations worked with. They had a primary, they had a secondary. Every 3 months, they would actually do a failover to the secondary and run the secondary as a primary, and vice versa. That is a recommended best practice. Okay, the reason behind that is that there's a couple of subtleties associated with that. Okay, your primary configuration and farm deployment and your secondary are identical. Okay, same hardware, same infrastructure. A lot of the time people want to have a DR environment, they actually run this in a reduced capacity. Okay, is that going to be a good thing? Possibly. Okay, depends on what your requirements are. The other thing about this too is that as part of your DR, and just explaining on a bit more about the plan, you should really have some different plans associated for your DR failover. One should be a planned failover. Okay, So, for example, you know that the example given yesterday's talk was that you know that a tornado is coming. Okay, so you may want to fail over to your secondary away from that particular disaster area. You know that it's coming, you've got time to do it. The other one could be an unplanned disaster. So there will be different types of steps and processes associated with that if you're doing an unplanned failover. For example, for the folks that live in Wellington, you don't know when an earthquake's going to hit, right? So potentially that could actually impact you and you don't know when that's going to happen. So really what that means is part of your DR planning, do at least have two different sets of documentation, one for a planned failover and one for an unplanned failover.
What's the other sort of, this is sort of good observations that have sort of customer done this as well. So some of the customer actually have the HTTPS actually implemented for their sort of really end user web application as well as the central administrations as well.
Yep. The other thing too is that if you've got a SharePoint 2013 deployment, everything in theory should be over SSL. Okay. In fact, that's part of our PLA standard. It's everything is over SSL. The simple reason behind it is that within a 2013, we're using OAuth behind the scenes, okay, and hence some credentials, kind of pseudo-credentials, are actually being passed around. So what that means is that as part of your standard deployment, please make sure that you're using SSL over everything.
Cool. The other technical implementations that I've seen some customer actually doing this with some sort of don't as well, which is having a database naming conventions that will basically make manageability of the database to be much easier, and the DBA will sort of love you as well for doing this rather than having a grid in your database name.
Okay, and we'll go into a bit more detail about that shortly.
And the other one is the no local administrators. I think I've only seen maybe one or two of these for a number of engagements that I've done. I think having no local administrators is actually a recommended way in terms of the security perspective, and we can actually do that as well with a SharePoint implementation.
Okay. So just with regards to the database naming, right? So hate GUIDs and database names. The DBAs hate you. Okay. So basically the guidance around here is that, you know, be nice to your DBAs and have a standard, and a standard is better than no standard. The only other thing I'd like to consider here is that do consider having multiple farms and multiple environments as part of your naming standards. Okay? Just think about that and just try and get a nice structure in there. So as a suggestion for the configuration, saying it's SPF1 config, know all the content databases, F1 content, or the service application starting with service, etc. on there. That way, if you do add additional farms, different environments into there, you do know which databases are actually being used there. So what we've basically done is that we've gone through, looked at RAP as a service, giving an overview about, you know, what actually happens with RAP, talked about some of the common issues that we've seen out there, showing you how you can do some of your performance monitoring, talked about future-proofing, as in get rid of your on-premises, you know, your full trust apps and go with SharePoint apps, and talked about some other considerations around, you know, disaster recovery and stuff like that. So with that, a little bit of a plug for Barry.
If you're interested with RAP S or PLA, you can sort of talk to us in Microsoft Services booth, or you can sort of email us as well at servicesnz@microsoft.com.
Okay. And there's some other sessions that you may want to be interested in. And we are, I think, right on time. We're 2 minutes to go for any questions that may or may not be in the room.
Do we have any questions? Oh, yep.
Okay, so the question is, I've got an always on, I'm using SQL Server always on, okay, which is fine. Okay, how do you handle the different synchronization requirements based on the SharePoint databases? The reality is you need, in my opinion, at least 4 different availability groups based, and basically you set up whether or not it's synchronous and asynchronous replication based on the database support standards on that. Okay?
Yep.
So the question is, how does Hostname Site Collections play with programmatically creating? Once again, you can do it. You can do it through code. Yeah. You just can't do it through the UI. The DNS component, that's fine as well, once again. But that's a common issue anyway, because once you just need the DNS to be able to resolve to the SharePoint service. So no change from that perspective.
I think that's what we do as well as part of the Office 365. There's a pattern and practice and guidance as well that sort of Steve Walker talked about yesterday. So if you would like to know more about that, I think there's a demo as well about that, about the site collections provisioning, and there's an Office 365 pattern and practice. So if you search for that, you'll sort of find some samples and demos as well.
Okay. So with that, we're a wrap. All right. Thank you. Enjoy the rest of TechEd. Sorry, Ignite.